So tonight we have a very special sangha in cyberspace, monastics in cyberspace, and also in real life. You must remember the real people as well. And we're very fortunate tonight to have joining us Venerable Aya Suvira. So Aya Suvira, who you'll see momentarily, because we have a slightly different setup today. Aya Suvira is a nun who's now living in Sydney, originally raised in rural Queensland.
That's correct.
And trained with the monastery in Newbury, down in Victoria. And how long, how many reigns do you have now since Upasampada?
Since my Upasampada, I have Tuvasa.
Mm-hmm. So she has two Vasas and probably a little bit more for your seminary time.
I spent 3 years as a seminary.
3 years as a seminary, 2 years as a bhikkhuni, and we're very fortunate to have her here with us tonight. She's going to lead the entire production. Isn't that wonderful? And so no pressure, Federal, no pressure. And so tonight, because the rules have been relaxed once again in Sydney, we can do some chanting, do some meditation, and we can also listen to Aya give her Dharma talk. And so without any further comments from me, I'd like you to make Aya Suvira very welcome.
Okay, hi everyone. Nice to see a lot of people online. Oh, nice to see you too, Aya Wimalanyani. Long time no see, Ishika. Okay, great. So before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that this event is taking place on the lands of the Burramatagal people of the Darug Nation, whose sovereignty has never been ceded. So we can begin this evening by saying Namo Tassa. You're welcome to join in, and we'll say Namo Tassa together 3 times.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa.
And we'll say the Itipiso.
Itipiso Bhagava Araham Sammasambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purusa Namasarati Satta Deva Manusanam Buddho Bhagavati Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandittiko Akaliko Ehi Basiko Upanayiko Vajatam Veditabo Vinyihiti Supattipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujupattipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapattipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipattipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidam Chattari Purusa Yugani Atta Purusa Pukkala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo dakineyo anjalikaraneyo anutarang punyaketang lokasati.
Okay, so I'm just going to follow the program as I have it here. So according to the program, we have 15 minutes of meditation. So today we'll be doing Anapanasati, or breathing meditation, for the next 15 minutes. So to do this, we'll sit comfortably in our seats. You know, if you need to wriggle around, now's the time to do it. We can make sure that our posture is nice and upright, while still maintaining the natural curve in our lower spine. We can place our hands in our laps, with our right hand gently resting on top of our left hand. And we can place our feet comfortably on the floor. We can gently close our eyes and bring our attention back to our bodies. We can relax the tops of our heads. So feeling all of the feelings in our heads and in our scalps, and just making our heads nice and relaxed. We can relax our foreheads. Relax our eyebrows. Relax our eyes. Relax our noses. Relax our cheeks. Relax our mouths. So making our whole face nice and relaxed. We can relax our neck and shoulders. So letting go of any tension that might be held in our shoulders. We can relax our left arms. Right down to the tips of the fingers. We can relax our right arms. Again, making sure that our right arms are completely relaxed, right down to the fingertips. We can relax our chests. Relax our backs. Relax our stomachs. Relax our left leg. Relaxing our left knee. Our left ankle. And our left foot. Right down to the tips of the toes. So our whole leg is completely relaxed. We can relax our right leg, our right knee, our right ankle, and relax our right toes. So the whole right leg is very relaxed. We can relax our whole bodies. And when we are feeling completely relaxed, we can gently and mindfully draw our attention to our breathing. So silently and mindfully, we can feel all of the feelings of breathing in. And again, gently and mindfully, we can feel all of the feelings of breathing out. So we'll do that together for the count of 10. Breathing in gently and mindfully, 1. And breathing out gently and mindfully, 1. In 2. And out 2. In 3. And out 3. 4. 4. 5. 5. 6. Out 6. 7. 7. 8. 8. 9. 9. In 10. And out 10. For the next 5 minutes, we can continue to breathe gently and mindfully, without counting. So just gently and silently drawing our attention to the feeling of the breathing. Slowly and gently, we can hear the sounds around us. We can hear the cars in the street. The clock ticking. We can draw our attention back to our whole body. We can relax our hands. And gently, gently open our eyes and come back to the room. Okay. So that was the breathing meditation. You know, there are different styles of doing these things, maybe a little bit different to the local style. Yeah, just one different way of doing it where you do it with the counting. So I'd like to really thank actually both Bhante Sujata and Bhante Akalico for having me here this evening. It's a real privilege actually to have the presence of Bhante Akalico here as well to support the program. So I understand that Bhante Sujata had been talking on the theme of the Buddha, of the Buddha's life. And the theme had been to separate the man from the myth. And this was all in the lead up to Vesak, which is very nice, you know, nice to gain some inspiration from the Buddha's life story. But I was reflecting a little bit more on this theme because I thought, actually, that's a really difficult thing to do. And one of the reasons why it's particularly difficult is that actually, most of the biographical stories we have for the Buddha are either late canonical or post-canonical. So even within the canon itself, there are several, you know, sources of Buddha biography, one of which would be the Nikayas themselves. But actually, quite a number of the stories that are told in Buddhist cultures, the sources for those are, say, the Dhammapada Attakatha, the Dhammapada commentary, the Udana commentary, also the you know, the Buddha Appadana within the Kuddhika Nikaya. So the whole concept of actually trying to separate out those stories into historical layers, on the one hand, you know, sure, it's it should be easy, right, just to pick out, you know, the sources that come from the early canonical texts like the Sutta Pitaka. But then I realized that the number of stories that we just associate as basic features of the Buddha's life are actually late canonical. So I was thinking about this, you know, if we were to separate out the Buddha, the man from the myth, you know, what would be the more human or less mythological characteristics of the Lord Buddha's life? And the first characteristic that came to mind would be, you know, the fact that the Lord Buddha did undergo physical suffering during his life. And this topic of, you know, why did the Lord Buddha suffer, it actually gets its own chapter in the Buddha Appadana, you know, which is the late canonical text that I mentioned, which deals with these things. And the reason why, you know, this particular topic, you know, gets its own chapter is because for Buddhist traditions, the whole concept of, you know, how our, you know, how our wonderful Lord Buddha, you know, who was so lofty and profound, how he actually had at the same time a body that suffered, in some ways it has been embarrassing for Buddhist traditions. And there has actually been a lot of intellectual effort poured into this topic of trying to explain, you know, on the one hand, you know, the Buddha was this perfect enlightened being, and on the other hand, you know, the Buddha suffered just like the rest of us. So I mean, just reading around this topic, you know, within the Buddha Apadana, you know, there are a list of, you know, the hardships that the Lord Buddha underwent during his life, you know, the first of which would be the austerities that the Buddha undertook as the Bodhisattva, and then also, you know, the slander, such as by Chincha Manavika, you know, the story of the lady who feigned pregnancy by tying the, I think she tied like a wooden pot or something over her stomach, and then the mice came and, you know, chewed off the cord, and, you know, it exposed her as the fake. And again, you know, that story of Chincha Manavika, I see Deepika nodding, you know, it's something that we accept so naturally as being part of the Buddha's biography. But then if you actually go and try to trace the sources for that story, as far as I'm aware, the sources for that story are all late canonical. So, you know, it's these stories that we accept as just being, you know, a given part of the Buddha's biography. They not always necessarily explicitly found in the Sutta Pitaka. And again, you know, the second case of slander, the case of Sundari, you know, Sundari was the lady who was murdered by the Paribhajikas, by this other sectarian group. And then they tried to pin it on the Buddha. That one, I think it is actually referenced in the Udana, but also some other commentary as well. So, you know, just thinking about ways in which the Buddha, you know, was very human, you know, he suffered just like the rest of us, that the traditions have then, you know, later tried to explain. So, you know, the Buddha's experience of slander, the Buddha's experience of being physically assaulted, for example, by Devadatta trying to kill the Buddha with a rock, you know, and after that, the Buddha getting hit with a splinter, you know, which again, according to the late canonical and post-canonical material, that splinter was later treated by the Buddha's doctor, Jivika, you know, and that was a second suffering for the Buddha, that he had to have the, you know, the wound lanced. You know, also the Buddha's, the fact that the Buddha was, you know, that Devadatta sent a mad elephant to attack the Buddha, the elephant Nalagiri, but also some other material too, like things that I just completely forgotten about, you know, thinking about the ways that the Buddha just suffered like the rest of us. Maybe the Buddha, you know, at least not in the early canonical material, you know, the Buddha didn't have COVID. I mean, maybe in some of the later material, you know, there was the pestilence at Vaisali, I think, you know, which was, you know, given as the occasion for teaching the Ratna Sutta. But in the Vinaya, you know, there's the famine at Viranja. And that's, you know, also I don't know if you know this story. Does anyone know this story where the, you know, there's nothing to eat and the Buddha and Ananda, they have to eat the barley that's offered by the horse traders? Because, yeah, I thought this story was a little bit more well-known than that, because that story about the famine at Viranja, that one, you know, it is also referenced in the Anguttara Nikaya. But, you know, the fact that the Buddha lived off horse feed for a period of his life, you know, maybe that could be seen as potentially embarrassing. You know, some of these hardships that the Buddha underwent. Yeah, also, like, for example, the headache. Again, according to the late canonical material, like the Apadanas, you know, during the massacre of the Sakyan clan, the Buddha had a headache that lasted for 3 days as a result of standing under this tree. So, you know, another example of just the Buddha undergoing incredible physical suffering. And the Buddha's very famous backache that Ante mentioned previously. You know, so there's actually a lot of material there that has been picked up, at least by the late canonical period. you know, as maybe being something that needs explanation, you know. And the way the Buddha Abhidhamma deals with that is to, you know, to take all of these incidents and to give them a karmic cause, you know, saying, for example, oh, the Buddha's backache, that was because in a past life he was a dwarf wrestler, you know, who picked up this guy and threw him and broke his back, and that's the karmic cause of the Buddha's backache. Although within the Sutta Pitaka itself, I don't think, you know, I don't think these particular incidents are explained in that way. And the reason I thought this particular topic was interesting is because when I think of the Buddha, you know, the image that first comes to mind, it isn't the Buddha under the Bodhi tree or anything normal like that. You know, what I see is the empty chair, like from the Sanchi Stupa. And, you know, do you know the one I'm talking about? You know, there's just the, like, the Bodhi tree and the empty seat, and people are coming to worship the empty seat. Is that an image that's familiar for people? No, not really?
Not really.
No, okay. Because in early Buddhist art, you know, at places like Sanchi, you know, where you have this stupa, you know, most of the artistic representation of the Buddha is it's either symbolic or in some ways an iconic, and that the Buddha isn't represented, you know, as a physical person. The Buddha is quite often represented by the empty chair, or by a footprint, or by some other type of symbol. So for me, it's actually very difficult to draw to mind sometimes an image of the Buddha, because on the one hand, you know, there's a kind of juxtaposition that on the one hand there's, you know, this very physical reality of the Buddha's body and all of the hardship that entailed, and on the other hand, you know, when Buddhist communities in the early days, when they wanted to represent their teacher, you know, what they actually represented wasn't even a body at all. It was just an emptiness, an empty space. And even though the worshippers are coming in around the Buddha, you know, they're depicted as human beings. You know, they're in the art with the body and with the garlands. We never get to see the Buddha. All we see is the emptiness. So the question I wanted to really go with for today is, you know, what does it mean to come, you know, as a real physically embodied human being, and to actually put ourselves in the position of the worshippers, say, you know, in the around the empty chair, and to actually conceptualize, you know, what it is we're worshipping when we worship the Buddha. So when I first began attending temple, one of the first things I ever learned, you know, the first Buddhism I learned, was this expression, yo tammang pasati, so mang pasati. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. And, you know, this particular expression was spoken by the Buddha to Vakali Thera. Has anyone heard of Vakali? Maybe, I'm sure Bhante Akaliko has, but has anyone else heard of Vakali? Okay, Adipika has, that's good. Because again, Vakali is very, very interesting because there's lots of stories about Vakali, and like they're kind of mutually contradicting each other. So the particular story I've picked for Vakali, just to make it very elegant and easy, we're just doing this Sanyutta Nikaya of Vakali only, because Vakali has multiple personalities. You do get these other stories about Vakali and his extreme devotion for the Buddha. But I'm sticking with the Vakali from the Sanyutta Nikaya. He's also in the Theragatha as well as in the Sutta Nipata, so he gets referenced a few times. So the Vakali Sutta is in the Theravaga of the Sanyutta Nikaya, and this particular sutta was given when the Buddha was at the squirrel's feeding ground in the bamboo grove at Rajagaha. And Vakali Thera was ill and staying in a potter's shed. So in the Theragatha, it talks about Vakali's wind ailment. So maybe it was the same wind ailment, but, you know, that's not particularly clear. So, I mean, the Bamboo Grove's a very nice place. They've added a lot more bamboo recently, so you can actually still go to the Velivana and see actual bamboo, which is very nice. You know, the Thai government's put in a SEMA there. I went with with Anoma, so did we see any squirrels though? Were there squirrels? No, there were squirrels. Oh, okay. Because I couldn't quite remember. So anyway, the Buddha was at the squirrels feeding ground in the bamboo grove at Rajagaha. And anyway, so Vakali is very sick in bed and he tries to get up to greet the Buddha, but the Buddha allows him to remain in bed. So what's happened leading up to that is that, you know, being sick, Vakali, you know, is probably, he knows he's going to die and he's requested that the Buddha comes to see him. Anyway, that's just what that's how I interpret it. All the text tells us is that Vakali requests the Buddha to see him. So the Buddha asks how Vakali is faring and he explains that his condition is getting worse. On hearing that Vakali is getting worse, he has a conversation with the Buddha, which goes as follows. So the Buddha asks Vakali, I hope you don't have any remorse or regret. And Vakali says, indeed, sir, I have no little remorse and regret. So Vakali actually has a lot of remorse and regret. And, you know, the Buddha questions a little bit further. You know, he says, I hope you don't have any reason to blame yourself when it comes to ethical conduct. And, you know, Vakali says, no, sir, I don't have a reason to blame myself when it comes to ethical conduct. And, you know, the Buddha asks him, you know, so Vakali, why is it then that you have remorse and regret? And Vakali says, for a long time, I wanted to go and see the Buddha, but I was physically too weak. So Vakali, you know, he's still quite attached to the physical body of the Buddha. And, you know, that attachment is giving rise to this remorse and regret. So the Buddha being very compassionate, you know, he wants to give him a teaching, maybe to help him to get out of that negative mind state. And, you know, what the Buddha says to Vakali, he says, you know, enough, Vakali, why would you want to see this rotten body? So he says, Alang Vakali, King te imina putikayena dipena. One who sees the teaching sees me. Yo ko Vakali tam mang pasati, so mang pasati. One who sees me sees the teaching. Yo mang pasati, so tam mang pasati. Seeing the teaching, you see me. The manhi Vakali pasanto mang pasati. Seeing me, you see the teaching. Mang pasanto tam mang pasati. So one who sees the teaching sees me. And one who sees me sees the teaching. The Buddha then gives Vakali a teaching on the impermanence of the khandhas, following which Vakali attains arahantship and sends his declaration via other monks to the Buddha. You know, later Vakali, presumably due to the burden of his illness, kills himself with a knife, and the Buddha subsequently confirms his attainment of arahantship. You know, in the Sutta Nipatha, the Buddha also holds up Vakali as an example of someone who was liberated because of his faith to Pingya. And the thing that's very interesting to me about this sutta is that it, you know, it shows the Buddha describing his personality in the Buddha's own terms. So, I mean, it's a very different feeling. It's not a hagiography, you know, it's just a statement of who the Buddha really was. And one of the terms that the Buddha gives for himself in the suttas is actually the term, you know, the body of the Dhamma or the embodiment of the Dhamma. So he actually, he, you know, he says, the Buddha says of himself, you know, that he is the Dhammakaya. And that's in the Aganya Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. So the Buddha calls himself you know, himself being the Tathagata in a very impersonal sense. He calls himself the Dhammakaya, the Brahmakaya, so, you know, the embodiment of Dhamma, the embodiment of holiness, Dhammabhuta, one who has become truth, and Brahmabhuta, one who has become holy. And, you know, I wanted to pick this term out a little bit because I thought, hey, this is a really kind of unique and interesting term because, you know, this term Dharmakaya, you know, it has a significant interpretation history in Buddhist texts of many traditions. It's also the name of a Thai Buddhist cult, Wat Dharmakaya, which has been implicated in financial fraud, among other things. And, you know, what's going on with their system's a bit different. Their system probably comes out of the Thai esoteric or yoga vachara system, sorry, the yoga vachara system. So, you know, their idea is that the Dharmakaya is actually like this literal astral or spiritual body that exists as a kind of reality inside your flesh body. And that's not what the Buddha is really going for. At least I don't think that's what the Buddha is really going for here. So what's actually meant by Dharmakaya, you know, this embodiment of the Dharma, it's not explicitly defined in the canon itself. It's actually a very low frequency vocabulary item, and it appears in one other place in the canon, in the late canonical Mahaprajapati Gotami Theri Apadana. So, you know, the story about Mahaprajapati Gotami Theri, where she uses it to apply to herself. You know, she says that, she also says, you know, I am the Dharmakaya, I'm the embodiment of the Dharma, which is interesting because it's, you know, drawing parallels between Mahaprajapati Gotami as being like a female Buddha, which is, you know, interesting in its own right. So we have this kind of word, you know, it occurs twice in the whole canon, not much interpretation around it. The commentary says that it means the Buddha's teaching of the nine super mundane attainments. So that would be, you know, the nine absorptions in the commentarial system. However, the sub-commentary seems to think that it's the Buddha's, you know, attainment of Bodhi itself. So quite interesting, you know, is what's meant by the fact that the Buddha embodies Dharma, you know, does it mean that he embodies the teachings as this kind of abstract whole, or does it mean that the Buddha's attainment of awakening? So that question, you know, even within the Pali tradition, it's a bit open-ended, and it has been dealt with in different ways within other traditions. For example, in the Mahavibhasha of the Savastivadins, you know, there's this statement that when we go for refuge in the Buddha, it's not the Buddha's physical body that's meant. It's the Buddha's, you know, the term used is, I think it's, sorry, it's his Bodhi, so his attainment of awakening, and his Dharmakaya. So quite interesting that other traditions have gone, you know, down the more inclusive route and said actually what's meant by Dharmakaya is both the awakening attainment and the, you know, the sum total of the teachings. You know, from my perspective, I think it's enough to say that the Dharmakaya is the sum of the Buddha's teachings in an abstract sense, and, you know, that's what the Buddha's personality embodies. So very interesting, you know, just to see the history around some of these terms that the Buddha used to describe himself in his own words. Because sometimes I think, you know, you can be very close to a person, but that doesn't necessarily mean you always know them. You know, there were actually people who were close to the Buddha during his lifetime but never really got to see the Buddha. Maybe people like Devadatta, you know, that he was the Buddha's cousin, I think, but he never had that experience of genuinely meeting the Buddha. I mean, maybe, you know, not in the sense of meeting this Buddha as he's defined himself as being the embodiment of Dhamma. You know, cause I think to really be able to understand someone, we need to have, you know, shared understanding and shared realities. And, you know, how do we actually meet the Buddha? You know, how do we get this kind of mental understanding of what's actually sitting in that empty chair? Personally, I'd say, you know, how do we meet the Buddha? It's through stream winning. It's through once returning. It's through non-returning and arahantship. So that's probably why the Buddha said, yo dhammang pasati, mang pasati, whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. So that concludes my talk for this evening. So Vesak is still a little way away on May 26th. So you all have time to become awakened before Vesak. No pressure. And I'm just checking how we're going for time. When do we normally finish up, Ante?
When we finish.
We finish up when we finish. Okay.
So there might be some questions from the audience, both in the room and perhaps online.
Okay. So I'd like to open up to questions then. I mean, questions on the content are good, but questions about stuff in general is also okay. So, any questions? Comments, feedback, complaints, queries? No questions. Okay, one from Nilushi, and I see one from, I've just had a mental blank. Your name is Max. Yeah, no, Dan. Daniel, okay. I think I saw Nilushi's hand first. Okay, so let's go with Dan first then.
Thank you for that talk. It was very interesting to know about the chat. And I was wondering if there was any relationship. I remember coming across something like, I think there was a stage just before Stream Entry where they talked about a body singer. And it's on somebody that's like pretty much almost definitely going to be a Stream Entry, but isn't quite. And the other one was, what do you mean by the Dharma is visible right here now? And the Buddha says, they can see it in the eye, they can see it in the ear, they can see it in the room.
That sounds like Bahia, yeah?
Like what?
In this seeing, there's only the seeing, or is that maybe that's a different sort of
translation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, sure. So there's two questions there. So I'll start with number one. So the first question is about stages before stream entry. So the two stages before stream entry are the Saddha Nisari and the Dhamma Nisari. So in the simile of the snake, in the Majjhima Nikaya number 22, the Alagadhipama Sutta, you know, the Buddha said, Sabbe te sambodhi pariyana. Yeah, you know, all of them, they're all bound for awakening. So, yeah, pretty much. Does that answer your question? So there's people maybe who might have the quality of, you know, investigation as their leading quality. So they become the Dhamma Nisari, and they gain confidence in the Dhamma that way. There's people who might have, you know, this personal characteristic of faith as being, you know, their predominant psychological characteristic. And, you know, that's how they eventually attain awakening. And like I was saying, you know, Pingya from the Sutta Nipata, you know, he's a very, very much a faith-based person. And he says, you know, no matter where I go, the Buddha never leaves me. You know, I'm always, you know, mindful of the Buddha. And, you know, Vakali, again, a very faith type personality. So people like Vakali, people like Pingya, you know, they'd be examples of the Saddha Nisari, you know, the faith follower. Does that answer your question?
So it's wondering how it's being related to the Dharmakaya,
Oh, that's okay. Because, I mean, in the Chula Hati Padopama Sutta, again, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there's another one of these nice yo-so statements. So today we did the yo-so statement, yo tammang pasati, so mang pasati, you know, whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. But in the Chula Hati Padopama Sutta, there's another, you know, nice statement, you know, whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. So, you know, how does being a Saddha Nisari or, you know, how does being a Dhamma Nisari, how does that feed into seeing the Dhamma? You know, when they become stream enterers, when they become Sotapannas, you know, what do they see? They see Paticca Samuppada, they see the Four Noble Truths. So that experience, you know, a stream entry is called Ditti Sampanno, you know, they're possessed of you. So they have actually seen the tamma at the level of you. So, and it only gets better from there. So, yeah, I mean, that's the first experience of seeing, and that, you know, that experience of seeing, you know, feeds in on the level of, you know, on the level of perception. So for the anagami, you know, there's the, you know, the fervor, two fetters that are severed, and, you know, even more fetters are severed at arahantship. So the seeing only gets deeper. But at the level of you, you know, it's there from Sotapanna. Did that make sense? Okay.
So these two types of people are regarded as on the path to stream entry, and they must gain stream entry.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Yeah, maybe that answers your question. That's how they get there.
Yeah. So if that's, is that okay to wrap up there for question number one, or is there anything else you'd like explored further? Is that, like, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
We can go to the next question. Okay, so the next question, I mean, did you have a particular sort of reference for that question?
It's in the Samhita in the five.
Sure, because I mean, it's just not coming to mind immediately.
Yeah. It's the bodhi. It's just bodhi. Like, how is it that the dharma is visible, but like here and now, timeless and touching investigation, and then we're just like, oh, when one doesn't conceive in the eye, when one doesn't conceive in the ear, when one doesn't conceive in the nose, I don't know. And the bodhi, yeah, the bodhi translation says conceive, and there's a whole series of them that are like that question.
Yeah, so I mean, what was the question you had about it?
This was in the realm of the comments. It was like that I find it interesting that if you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha, and then there'll be a link, and then because like somebody else had the Buddha, like, how is it that the Dharma is apparent here and now? And then it says they conceive.
Okay.
I find that interesting because in another tradition as well, there's they say if you pass this koan, you will see the patriarchs, the ancestors face to face. So that's a kind of another use of, I think, Dhammakaya. But
yeah, that's very lovely, actually. You know, yeah. Severing the I am conceit. I think that's probably what's meant, you know. You sever the I am conceit, you get to see the Buddha. It's quite interesting, actually, in the Theragatha, quite often the monks, the terms they use to describe their own awakening experience, sometimes they say, I've become like the Buddha. And I thought that's quite nice too, because, you know, we want to be close to our teacher, you know, to actually to be able to say, you know, I've become like the Buddha. You know, what more could we wish for than to actually share in some sense in that same realization the Buddha had? So yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's very lovely. Yeah. Oh, okay. Questions online. Okay, this is from a Thumbabum. Did I understand correctly that some of the later writings contain more mythical content than the earlier writings in order to clarify or expand upon stuff that was reported in the earlier writings? So I gave the specific example of the Buddha Appadana's treatment of the question of why did the Buddha suffer physically in this life in terms of karma. And I'd say, yes, the reason why that text is there is probably to clarify an apparent problem that may have arisen from the earlier material, which is that the physical suffering of the Buddha might have been seen as somewhat embarrassing or in need of explanation within the tradition. So I'd say that's probably true of that text. And that text is quite interesting, actually, because the commentary on that text is actually hidden. Very interesting. So that particular chapter of the Buddha Apadana, the commentary, has actually been sandwiched in the wrong place. It's been sandwiched in the Thera Apadana commentary, like actually literally hidden away in the wrong place in the commentary on the biographies of the Theras. And you wonder, why would they do that? Like, just why is the Buddha Apadana commentary? I think it's actually in the Visuddhijana Vilasini. Why has it been sandwiched there of all places? And, you know, just being a little bit conspirational, I think maybe they were actually trying to hide, like in a very literal sense, trying to hide the commentary. Because, you know, what's happened obviously over time is that in certain Indian Buddhist traditions, the Buddha has taken on this kind of larger-than-life personality. If you read the commentaries, the feeling's very different to the suttas. You know, it's always, you know, the Buddha gave out so many rays of light, and there were so many flowers that, you know, that showered from heaven. And yeah, the feeling can be very exaggerated by the commentarial period. So I hope that answers your question, Thammabum, that in relation to that particular text, I think there is a question that the tradition wanted to look at in more detail. Okay, Gillian, following Thammabum's question, to what extent are there sources for the late canonical material outside of the early canon? I mean, I gave one example of the Apadana texts. Again, the Apadanas are found in the Kuttika Nikaya. So some of the Kuttika Nikaya is early, other parts of the Kuttika Nikaya are late. So within the Kuttika Nikaya, say the Dhammapada, the Udana, the Therigatha, are generally regarded as early, whereas other texts, like the ones I mentioned, later. And the Apadana texts, they have a kind of close date that's probably estimated at around 200 BCE, just to give a ballpark for that. I hope that answers your question. Okay, Central West Buddhists. Thank you, Aya. You outlined a number of stories earlier and talked about lateness versus earliness. To what extent do you feel that the historicity of texts is important? In biblical scholarship, this is a hot topic. I'm wondering what the Buddhist view on this is. Thank you. I think others have asked similar questions. I mean, this is very much, this is a Bhante Sujato and Ajahn Brahmali type question. I believe that they wrote a book on it, which is available in PDF format via the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies, called The Authenticity of Buddhist Texts. Many of my friends have actually read that book and they found it quite helpful. For me, yeah, I mean, the question of is the historicity of texts important, for me personally, I'd say yes and no. Yes, in the sense that you know, you just really want to have this deep, incredible respect for the Lord Buddha, and you try to live your life as if the Lord Buddha were in the room right next to you. And I think, you know, the most respectful thing we could possibly do, you know, to live our lives as if we were in the literal presence of the Buddha, would be to take the word of the historical Buddha seriously, and that if that involves, you know, a quest to work out on, you know, on archaeological, linguistic, you know, or on text critical grounds, you know, what was actually spoken by the historical Buddha. I think that's a very respectful exercise. But on the other hand, I mean, for me personally, I'm interested in something called reception history. So reception history is more like a history of readers or a history of interpretation. So when you, I mean, it's a bit of, if you're interested in biblical scholarship, maybe you've heard this term. It's a bit of a developing history. Sorry, a bit of a developing area. But the thing with reception and interpretation history is that you don't necessarily always need to get into this quest for origins. You can just look at the intellectual development of ideas and take that as it is. That being said, though, I think maybe there are some good ideas that are late ideas. But quite often what happens within Buddhist traditions is that the later ideas aren't often, you know, the more interesting ones. I think very much in terms of Dhamma, the early ideas are still the relevant and best standard. So next question from Ashwini. In general, Aya, are there some suttas you would suggest that are good reading for learning through key Dhamma concepts the Buddha taught? Or alternatively, which are your favorite suttas that you for the most benefit from? Okay, so alternatively, which are your favorite suttas that you benefit most from? Oh, that's a really good question, actually. I have to apologize. I feel very apologetic. When I first started learning Buddhism, my introduction to Theravada was via the Thai forest tradition. My first teacher was Lungta Mahaboa. And, you know, if you have been exposed to that particular strand of Tamayut Buddhism, you would be aware that reading suttas was not actually a part of my early Buddhist education. It's only really much more recently, and mostly as a result of Bhante Sujato's work, that I have actually, had any serious education in the Sutta Pitaka. So, I like to chant. I will actually chant the Dhammajakkappavattana Sutta, the Anathalakkhana Sutta, and the Adita Pariyaya Suttas, which are, you know, the first three suttas taught by the Lord Buddha after his awakening. And I mean, you know, the Anathalakkhana Sutta is a very deep, profound, and beautiful sutta. So, yeah, it's good. You know, if you can learn those suttas and chant them, it's really something that's beneficial to do. Okay. So, is there anything else? Is now okay, Nilishi?
The question I had was what you were saying about the Buddha being, you know, in the early Buddhist teachings described as very much a human having difficult experiences like slander and you know, dealing with less than ideal conditions for support. That sort of thing that us humans deal with. I just wondered what, for me personally, I think in a way that's more interesting and inspiring than all the stories about how he came out of the side of his mother's body and put a finger up and started walking a bird and all that sort of thing. You know, I feel like the things that describe him as a human being, it's more like what's more crucial to me is how he responded. So I just wondered, you know, what in those stories. You know, what you found the most inspiring with regard to how he actually related to those imperfections of being a human being, is anything
interesting? I mean, yeah, that's a really interesting point because, you know, that whole narrative of the Buddha's birth, a lot of it is very symbolic. For example, taking a step to the north, you know, the word for north in Pali is Uttara. So, you know, when the Buddha takes a step to the north, you know, what's the text actually trying to tell us? You know, the text is telling us that the Buddha is Anuttara. You know, there's a pun involved. So I think, you know, to try to read the birth narrative text literally is to do them a deep injustice because, you know, the whole thing is just so, it's about symbolism. It's not about this is something that actually happened, you know, the whole white parasol, you know, that's this whole idea of, you know, purity. And I think some of the other symbolism, you know, taking the seven steps, you know, why does the Buddha take seven steps? It's because in the future he'll possess the seven vajangas. So sometimes these texts have like nearly an esoteric meaning that needs to be drawn out. So some texts, you know, they that, yeah, I think the term is nayata. Is that the correct term, Bhante?
Sorry.
A text that requires its meaning to be drawn out. In Sanskrit, it's nayata. In Pali, I think it's nayata. But some texts, you know, the meaning, it requires you to actually know the symbolic language that the text is trying to express. Yeah, so I mean, like some of these more human things, they're quite approachable because they don't require you to know to engage in the wordplay or the complex symbolism. You know, they're just there. One of the things I find very inspiring in the Buddha's life, I think there's an occasion actually where the Buddha, you know, it's cold. It's in the in the middle of winter. It's snowing, or you know, in that period. You know, just the really cold period, and the Buddha sleeps just on the road. And I think someone asks him, you know, did you how could you sleep like that or something like that? And he says, actually, I always sleep happily. And for me personally, that's very inspiring. Just that idea of just being happy and always sleeping happily, because there's people who live in, you know, very large places and they never get a proper night's sleep. You know, all of these people in high stress corporate jobs, you know, but the Buddha, he's just there on the track in the cold and the road, and the Buddha's sleeping happily. I mean, there's a few other little things like that too that show the Buddha's personality, just little quirky things. I mean, there's another place where the Buddha says, you know, the time I'm happiest is when I'm, again, just on the side of the road and there's no one there, not even to go to the toilet. Like there's no one even, you know, doing their business on the side of the road. There's just no people. And I think that's also very human because, you know, the Buddha would have spent so much of his time in cities surrounded by the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the kings, the ministers, the sectarians, you know, the laymen, the laywomen. And, you know, it's very personal to hear the Buddha describe his own happy time as just being on the roadside with no one there. I think it shows the Buddha's own, you know, internal happiness and internal contentment.
Especially in context of suffering, you know.
In the context of
seen as hardship by, yeah, you know, an ordinary person. That's, yeah, what's interesting, is you can relate to the difficulties, you know, with a more transcendent mind. That's what I find in this
time. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I don't know how much of that actually picked up on the microphone, but Nalushi was just saying, she said it was very inspiring for her, you know, to see the Buddha, you know, was able to experience suffering in a very human way and to mentally transcend that. So, yeah, was there anything else?
Sadhu.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Venerable.
Is it okay? I'll just conclude with merit dedication. So I don't know the local style. I have to apologize. So I'll just do the one I know. You're welcome to join in if you know it. Akasata cha bhummata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirangrakkhantu sasanang. Akasata cha bhummata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirangrakkhantu desanang. Akasata cha bhummata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkhantu mang bharanti. Okay, that concludes the session for this evening. Thank you, everyone, for having me. And maybe I'll see you around in Sydney or wherever you are in the world, maybe after COVID, not now. Okay, see you all. Bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.